The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. Don't mind that struggle in the background. It's just part of the fun. Is everybody okay?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Okay.
I'm back.
So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
So between the three of us, we're going to give you 2 hours of fun.
I like
radio.
How you refer to it as an episode. It's like reality TV.
Yeah, it's an episode. Well, as opposed to having an episode.
I have episodes every once in a while.
And it's kind of where I was headed.
You have to do that. Kind of clears you out a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, a good episode will do a body good. So today we're talking. Today's going to be interesting, actually. And so I figure we'll have a segment of people who will kind of freak out and think that we're being whatever, but this would not be a politically correct show on a good day.
I've been accused of being whatever many times.
I know. I had a variety of things. I thought I'd just lump them all under the category of whatever.
Whatever.
We have Elaine Willman on with us today, and hold on here. Let me get the book so I read the subtitle correctly. The name of her book is Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. So you're probably thinking we're going to talk about, you know, voting and politics and candidates and stuff, but not today. Today we're going to talk about tribalism and what's happening with our Indian tribal policy. She'll, of course, have all the proper lingo, but just so you know, she's a mom and a grandma, and her mom and her grandma were enrolled Cherokee members. Her spouse is of Shoshone ancestry, and little fact here. He's a direct descendant of Sacagawea.
Wow.
I know. Like, harken back to what, sixth grade? When do you learn about Sacagawea? Like, elementary school?
Something
when you're
like that,
building dioramas? She serves as the national chair of Citizens Equal Rights Alliance and did that from 2001 to 2007. Remains an active SARA board member. And she has blended her local land use and strategic planning expertise with federal Indian policy. And the purpose of that was to inform, engage counties, towns, and citizens that are co-located within or near federally recognized Indian reservations. I think you'll be surprised at how much this affects you. So, you know, there's always a segment of people out there thinking, I don't think I care about this, and I don't think it has anything to do with me. Well, if you're a taxpayer, you should keep listening. We try not to do topics that don't affect large numbers of people, and bottom line is, if you're a taxpayer, this is coming out of your pocket, and you should, it's kind of hidden, I guess. Bill's typing, so he can't speak.
Oh, sorry. I told my mom never to text me during the radio show, and I felt compelled. Darn mom. Not really.
I could have to poke you with this pen, am I?
Yeah. Yeah, you will.
So you read the stuff yesterday.
I did read it. And it was funny. It was an angle I'd never thought of before. As a country, we go overseas and we fight, you know, wars over countries that are tribal in nature, and we try to bring them democracy and teach them about democracy. And little did I know that in this country we promote tribalism, just the opposite.
We're going backwards.
Yeah, we're going backwards, and it was interesting.
And for those of you that are concerned that our Constitution is being run over, ignored, or however,
just basically ignored.
Yeah, this is operating outside our Constitution. So we literally have United States citizens
that are not, or maybe they don't want to be.
They have the protection of the Constitution,
right?
But they get to have their own
tribal
own
laws
government.
As well.
Yeah, their own government, yeah. And we pay for all that. So anyway, with that nutty introduction, Bob, do you have anything to add there?
Elaine sure has a lot of fans in Montana that are trying to hear the show right now.
Oh, is that what's going on?
Yeah.
I know you were over there. I'm like, what are you? Bob's become Ernestine the operator.
Oh, there's another one.
That's pretty interesting. So you can find a ton of information, information about the book and all that and about Elaine at wethepeopleradio.us. And there's a link there for her book. There also is a link to a News with Views article. I'm sure some other stuff will come up, and we'll link that as we go. But I think you'd be surprised to know that there are, I've got a little clip from the book here, that at least 90 major public spaces and natural resources, including Redwood National Monument in California and Joshua Tree National Monument in California, are targeted by the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, the National Park Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to be turned over to private tribal governments. The list includes 41 national refuges, 34 national parks, wildlife refuges, and hatcheries. It also includes 15 regional water projects. In each instance, a tribe will take over the management of the public lands. The problem is that what tribes do rarely involves any public process, oversight, or transparency. As can be seen in the areas where tribal governments have taken over or been given oversight of public land, public access is often limited or ended, and the tribes won't pay for the management of the sites. Okay, guess who pays for it?
Taxpayers?
Check.
Yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully we've given you a reason to stick with us this morning and learn about this, because honestly, this is flying right under the radar, but your elected representatives will be voting on this and may not know a whole lot about it, so it's your job to carry the torch and get them the information. So Elaine, how's it going today in the beautiful land of Montana?
It is going very great, Aaron, and I love listening to you guys. Banter.
I feel like listening to us try to awesome try to condense your entire book down into like. She's like, oh,
and thank you. Huh?
I'm thinking you're probably wondering, why'd she pick that part?
Well, but, that's a good part to pick because it kind of fits in with the big picture. That book and the information you just read was current in 2005, and it has progressed over the past 10, 11 years. To even the more so. So that was a good good piece to wake up all of American taxpayers.
Well, I don't know that people understand really the kind of, like one of your clips here, you had a small Montana tribe of 5,100 people. In 2004, they had an operating budget of $373 million.
Uh-huh.
Do the math.
And that, mm-hmm. Oh, and there's more where that came from.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Major multi-million-dollar contracts from the Department of Defense. This quiet little tribe, I was really stunned because it's not a nationally visible tribe, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai up here on the Flathead. You don't hear much about them in the paper, hardly anything. And I've been traveling the country and studying Indian tribes and Indian law and policy for 24 years now. And I knew very little about this tribe. I was just stunned at their connections with our federal government and what they're up to. But I'd like to kind of back up and thank you for mentioning my Indian ancestry, because I am called anti-Indian quite frequently, and it's kind of a conflict for me. As you said, my mother and grandmother were enrolled. I am enrollable, but I choose not. I think for the listeners, I had to do a lot of personal sorting before I got into this, because I've had a lifetime affection for American Indians and the history of our country and the noble American Indian warrior and plainsman and all of that. I grew up learning about that and loving it. And so when this issue hit me in the face or at my front porch in Toppenish, Washington back in 1992, I had to really do some personal sorting, and the way I did that was that I make very clear separations from my respect for all culture, certainly Native American culture, but all cultures, and that separates from government decision-making. And so my focus and my research and everything I say and do is based on government decision-making, and that's what federal Indian policy is. It's secret government decision-making. It's yep. best kept secrets between federal bureaucrats and congressmen and a few tribal leaders, and tribal members and the rest of us are out of the loop and uninformed.
But it affects it affects all of us, and not only in the wallet,
yes.
but Just yes. our control of our public land and also yeah. Our
yeah.
power generation and all sorts of different things. There's a lot of aspects of
it. It is now. It has truly exploded in the last 8 years, but it was starting to explode way back in the Nixon administration.
And maybe, Elaine, maybe you could go back to, I know a lot of our listeners are including myself, was totally ignorant about Indian law, but where did this all start? I've read some of the stuff you have here, and mm-hmm. right around the Civil War, maybe you could pick it up there and how we started off or kind of got off the trail and making these
yes.
Indian laws and kind of circumventing our Constitution.
Well, you must be reading my mind, Bill, because I put some dates down. I've got a little yellow slip of paper here with some key dates, because one of the things about this beautiful country is it's a very young country. When you're only going back 200 years instead of thousands of years, mm-hmm. the history of our country is fairly easy to track, and the Indian policy tracks with it as the country grew and had its problems. I'll start with the year 1855, which was before the Civil War.
Okay.
But it's a critical year for Indian policy, particularly in the Northwest, because most of the Indian treaties were executed by a fellow named Governor Isaac Stevens in 1855. So when I hear and as my own studies came along, and I'm seeing all that's going on for tribal governments that is not reaching down to its people, all the money, all the programs, all the authority and jurisdiction, but it's not reaching down to its people, who as enrolled members have no civil rights or Bill of Rights. The tribal governments don't recognize the Constitution, even though they have their own Constitution. But anyway, back to 1855, I kind of looked at what was going on in the United States in 1855. And in 1855, that was 5 years before the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
and all hell was breaking loose with the North and South. In 1855, that was before we heard the call, "Go West, young man." We'd already picked up Louisiana purchase lands, and rails were already moving across to the West Coast. And in 1855, these treaties were executed. The Department of War then, which later transitioned to the Department of Interior, but the Department of War was concerned with two folks. They were concerned with the fighting amongst Indian tribes, and they were concerned about the fighting with settlers and vice versa, and they were very interested in settling the West. So they say, "Go West, young man." Young man was given nothing by the federal government except what he could put in his wagon and his own things, and he was given the dream that you can go out west and you find a piece of ground, you improve that piece of ground, we'll give you a homestead patent with a water right attached to it, and you can help settle the West. That's what young man was given, just a dream, and go find a piece of ground. American Indians in 1855 were given their treaties. Now, their treaties come from Old English property law. They're really a sales contract.
And they were not citizens at that time, correct?
No, they were not citizens. There were Indian citizens. That in the Constitution, you see a little thing that says Indians not taxed. Some Indians were citizens as landowners in the New England states, and were taxed and were citizens. If they owned property, they were citizens, and some Indians did, and then, even back then. But in any event, the treaties provided Indians, let me just start with the Bureau of Indian Affairs served two purposes in 1855. It was to protect the Indians and to protect the settlers, and to protect both from each other. They were serving two of our populations. So these treaties are set up, and the Indians are ceding land that they are paid for, like a sale. They're ceding land, and they are provided land that is their Indian reservation, and they have the protections of the federal government, and they have the ongoing beneficial use and occupancy of that land, and that's their reservation. They were also given blacksmiths, doctors, schools, commodities, foods, every year since 1855, American Indians have been given a number of, you know, abundant resources from the federal government. But in 1855, young men going west was given nothing. In 1855, we were still buying and selling black Americans as cattle, as property.
Right.
In 1855.
And that was an issue that had, they had to address that pretty carefully when they were addressing the Indians as well. Because if you give something to one, you have to give it to the other.
There's a direct connection. Because as when the Civil War came on and the South secedes and the war goes on and then the war is ended and the United States is trying to bring the Southern states back into the full United States and we have all these Reconstruction laws, one of the Reconstruction laws was the War Powers Act, which allowed those plantation owners in the South that were refusing to free their slaves under the War Powers Act. Marshals could go in on those plantations and take the slaves, which are considered property, not humans, but property, and transport them north where they could be freed under the War Powers Act. Well, that same act, when that process was essentially concluded, there was a Freedmen's Bureau, Federal Freedmen's Bureau, that freed the slaves from belligerent plantation owners. And when that process was pretty much concluded under the War Powers Act, it was the Freedmen's Bureau was transitioned and integrated into the Bureau of Indian Affairs so that the federal government could keep the War Powers Act for all the territories out in the West. And the Indians were at that time were considered federal instrumentalities, and those that are enrolled still are. But that War Powers Act had validity in all the territories until I think you had to have 30,000 people in an area to create a state until the new states in the West were formed up. That was 1855. But my point about that is no American individuals of any ethnicity were given anything from the federal government in 1855 except American Indians. So then those treaties were set up to be temporary. The Stevens Treaties all throughout the Northwest were set up to be for about 25 years. Congress, in its thinking in those years and those times, was really thinking that it would take a couple generations for American Indians to understand and embrace and assimilate the A word, tribal governments hate, and to become full citizens of the United States. So that was the plan. Temporary treaties for 25 years. And if you move forward from a little over 25 years, by 1871, Congress ended all the treaty making because the assimilation movement was the goal.
And how many tribes had they made treaties with by then? So
there were 65. Well, there are several hundred treaties. There are multiple treaties with individuals.
Oh, that's right. How many? But it was under 100 tribes at that time.
Yes, and that gets very important in our contemporary times.
Absolutely. Okay, we have to take a really quick break. I just wanted to tie up that tiny loose end. When we come back, we're going to dig.
We'll pick up the story.
We're going to dig farther into this.
It gets better.
Because honestly, I think a lot of people now are kind of curious, you know, how does this work? You know, they get to have their own sovereign government, but where do we fit? And we're going to explain that today. Well, I'm using the term we loosely. It's Elaine. She's going to explain that. So you're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with Elaine Willman, author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. Stick with us. You've got a lot of information on the site, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
They took the whole Cherokee Nation, put us on this reservation, took away our ways of life. Hawk and a bow and knife, took away our native tongue,
taught their English to our young. And all the beads we made by hand are nowadays made in Japan. Cherokee people, Cherokee tribe, so proud to live, so proud to die.
There you go.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the Cherokee Nation.
That's Elaine's mom and her grandmother.
I really love that song. I have always loved that song.
I've always liked that song, too. We seem to be playing it a lot lately.
We have a rich American history. The kids don't get in, well, they haven't for decades, get in school anymore. And the American Indian played a very strong part in that, and some of it has been very, very painful. But, I just really love that song. You know, so let me pick up where I left off.
Please
I
do.
Was at 1871 when Congress ended treaty making, and then they moved forward. Their goal was to bring Indians into full citizenship and give them the opportunity to own land and be full citizens with all other Americans. And so they were heading towards that Allotment Act, the Dawes Act of 1887. That was about, a little longer than 25 years after the treaties. They brought in the Dawes Act, and the Dawes Act opened up those reservations to individual Indians that were allowed the opportunity to have their own personal piece of ground with a water patent attached to it, guaranteed water and a piece of ground. And as that tribal member received his allotment, he walked away from his tribal government, and he became a citizen of that state with his allotment. He was no longer under the tribal government. He was a citizen of the state with the Dawes Act and all those allotments that opened up the Indians. And they followed that with a Homestead Act to encourage settlers to go onto the Indian reservations and homestead some land, and this was all the process of, you know, building the first schools, the first churches, the first little communities and towns, and it was part of settling the West. One thing to note is that the homesteaders that were in many cases, and it certainly applies here, according to the history of the elders of this tribe. The homesteaders were very, very helpful. There was a lot of friction between whites or settlers and Indians, but there was also pretty good relationships, too. As an example, what was going on here on the Flathead Reservation was there were many, many tribes in the area, and they were all fighting with each other over bison and the Salish Kootenai. Men were getting killed in great numbers, and they were not able to access the bison, and they were a bison subsistence tribe. And so as the homesteaders came out, and this is according to their own elder history, as the homesteaders came out, they armed the Indians and fought with the Indians to fight off the Salish Kootenai, to fight off these very aggressive tribes that were taking all the bison. And then they helped the Indians learn farming, and, so there were good relationships between the homesteaders and Indians on reservations in many cases. You never hear about that now, but there were. So moving forward to, I want to just tag the year 1921, and I'll come back to it. But in 1921, Secretary of Interior Albert Fall, along with the West getting settled, Albert Fall, the Secretary of Interior, famously known for the Teapot Dome scandal, for which he was impeached and went to prison, that this Secretary of Interior, Fall, required that all the new water and energy systems being installed in the West be located on or near Indian reservations. Now, that's a key piece that occurred 100 years ago that has big play now in 2016, so I'll come back to it. But again, moving forward in 1924, with the reservations opened and the Homestead Act and the Indians are being assimilated, we're all going to be one people. The Snyder Act, all American Indians were made full citizens. Snyder Act. It should have all been over. All of this federal Indian policy should have ended on or about 1924, when every American Indian then and now, is a full American citizen. Then we had this catastrophe, I call it a catastrophe, happened 10 years later in 1934. An avowed communist by the name of John Collier, who had been living and studying the Pueblo Indians in the Southwest, and had published books on communism, he thought the communal living of the Pueblo tribe was the way to go for Indians, and he thought the Indians were losing all their land, and he proposed the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. That was an about-face, a complete turn away from everything that had been put into place from 1855 to 1934. He said, these Indians need to live separately. They need to have their culture, and we need to help them do that, and they need to have their own government, and so there's the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934.
So they were citizens, and then it's like, no, now you're not citizens. Now you have to be separate.
Yes, they became dual, and this is the schizophrenia of federal Indian policy, frankly. They became dual citizens. They were full citizens of the United States off of their reservation, but those who were enrolled in a tribal government were not full, lose that full citizenship. They lose the Bill of Rights. They have no 14th Amendment. There is an Indian Civil Rights Act that's, I call it toilet paper because there's no enforcement authority, and the tribal members have a very different governing system than what you and I and folks across the country do. They have no protections from their own tribal government. They have no recourse. They can't go into a state or federal court and say, my government has harmed me. And if they bravely disagree with the tribal government decision, there is retaliation. And I've been working with people that have been, tribal members here that have been severely punished for speaking up against some of the stuff going on here. But anyway, this 1934 was a key turning point that started growing tribalism across the country. And that just escalated even further under the Nixon policy. Now, going back to this War Powers Act, the War Powers Act that was put in place in 1871 was for territories. As the states became states and the federal territories went away, the War Powers Act could not be used against a state. But that was used to settle and organize the states, and that was used to carve out Indian reservations. And Nixon was one who wanted to really grow federal government. And Nixon saw that that war powers was still available to it. And the Nixon policies under his watch from 1969 through 74 greatly ramped up the authority of the federal government over states, created the Environmental Protection Agency and some other little beastly organizations. And Nixon was had a strong belief that the tribal members were better off living apart from the rest of the world in their own government, and he really, really escalated the growth of tribalism in this country. Clinton, when Clinton came on by 93, he did the same thing. Prior to Clinton, the funding for Indian tribes came almost solely from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Clinton created an executive order that required every federal agency to set up an Indian office within its agency and to set up consulting protocols and to include tribal governments in their budgeting of these 29 federal agencies. So now the funding going out to these tribes is not just from one, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it's from all 29. So here's where the taxpayer really needs to pay attention if we just do the math. 29 federal agencies are now annually funding 566 tribal governments. 29 agencies funding 566 tribal governments every year. Since the Clinton administration, and actually since further back in 1934, and actually for all the way back to 1855, but we now have 566 tribes where at the time of their citizenship there were about 65. It has just exploded under the Nixon administration and Clinton administration, and the Bush administrations were no better. the federal Indian policy has quite a lucrative money wheel that I don't know if I want to talk about that, but you're probably coming up on a break again.
We are.
So
we need to take a really quick break. Give us a dollar figure. What kind of money goes out annually from these 29 agencies?
Isn't that interesting? Because nobody's ever looked.
That's a great reason.
Nobody, and they won't look. They will not look. They have been requested and required to look. And we say, oh, well, we just can't count it all up. You know, but it's huge. I'm guessing it's equivalent to our military defense budget. Just doing the math. And just look at the tribe here has $373 million annual operating budget. The tribe where I lived in Wisconsin had a $574 million annual operating budget when there was only about 3,000 tribal members in the area. The money is huge.
But the poverty needle hasn't
changed at all. And that's part of the problem. There's no oversight, no accountability. These tribal governments are run by ruling families. For the large part, there are decent ones. I'm certainly not saying they're all rotten, but the money does not get down and out to upgrade the quality of life of their people. And to me, that's just obscene. When you look at the amount of money these tribes are raking in every year, but they just have waiting lists for housing, and it's just pitiful. It's unfair, and they can't speak out against it.
Yeah, it's not working. At the end of the day, it's not working out for anybody.
Not for anybody. Not for anybody. It's kind of a dinosaur that should have gone away in 1924, and now now it's just an ongoing conflict in one state after another, with all this stuff that has been piled on to the benefit of not just tribal leaders. I'm going to say it greatly benefits Congress. There's a whole Indian industry, all the law firms, all the lobbyists. You know, all the slot machine manufacturers.
I was going to say, the casino industry has done all
right. Oh, yes. Yeah, and that's the money wheel I want to talk about.
All right. We're going to come back and chat more about that. We have Elaine as our hostage for the full 2 hours today. So just in case you thought we were going to wrap this up in 20 minutes, we're not. We have another hour. You're listening to We the People Radio with Aaron, Bill, and Bob. We're speaking with Elaine Woman, author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. We'll be right back. President Nixon, but I don't think any of us knew he had anything to do with Indian policy. Every week we learn some stuff we either didn't know or forgot.
Hey, Elaine, I imagine you're probably going to get to this, but just want to make sure that we don't forget about the 13th and 14th Amendments and how they all kind of played into this whole story.
they had a big play in that they did not apply to Indians. They excluded, the 14th Amendment excluded Indians. And that's part of the problem today.
Right.
And that's part of the struggle that tribal members have with their own tribal governments today. Our national organization has been pounding on Congress over for a number of years and talking about the 14th Amendment as necessary to be provided for tribal members for many, many years. So far, it's not getting anywhere. And it is a protection that all other American citizens have, but Indians don't. So it's a very sad piece of the decision-making that the government has done on this. I want to move up to 1988 as quickly as possible and talk about this money wheel, but I will say that during the Nixon administration and thereafter, a good deal of major legislation, the Indian Self-Determination Act, came on, and that allowed tribes greater freedom to more autonomously self-govern. It also bloated up the federal funding that started going out to the tribes. Then they gave them the Indian Civil Rights Act, so that was in right before Nixon. That that gave them, that was, you remember the civil rights battle where our whole country went through, Brown versus Board of Education and whatnot. Well, Congress thought Indians needed civil rights too. And they put in the Indian Civil Rights Act, but they forgot to put any enforcement mechanism or any recourse that a tribal member could have or pursue if his civil rights are violated. So it's a nice fairy tale piece of legislation on the books that looks good, and it is of no use to the tribal members that have problems with their tribal government. Where this thing went totally off the rails, one big push that started was a 10-year period. I need to say, in 1988, Congress gave American Indians the gambling monopoly with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And you know what was funny for me? When I hear about that, I'm thinking, oh, wow, we used to have to do destination gambling. We'd go out to Atlantic City or Vegas or Tahoe, and our country would do destination gambling. And I thought, boy, the American gaming industry is going to fight this. Long-o. The American gaming industry jumped in full force. I call it McDonald's for the mob, because it put casinos across the country on Indian reservations. These non-tribal gaming industries at every level, investors and whatnot, would go find a tribe. They'd even go help a tribe get federally recognized and say, we'll help you with your federal recognition. We'll pay for the process. We'll buy the land. We'll build the casino. We'll train your employees, and we'll just take a 7-year management contract from you so you can get your casino open. So the American gaming industry has greatly profited from the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, because the tribal folks they had the gaming monopoly, but they did not have the expertise or skills to build and train and operate their own casinos. So rather than fight the monopoly, it is a federal monopoly, the rest of the gaming industry jumped right in, and that's why you have over 130 casino tribes in California, in casinos, off reservations and on all your best exits. But that set up the money wheel, and this is the money wheel I want to talk about, because our country went through a 10-year period between 2000 and 2010. Things were rolling along, and the political clout and financial clout of American Indians was on the move, but it really came into play in the year 2000. We have a Federal Election Commission, an FEC, and this election commission is three appointed persons. They are not elected, and they put out advisory opinions. They're just advisory opinions. But in May of 2005, the Federal Election Commission put out an advisory opinion, and this is right before the Bush-Gore presidential election. In May of 2005, the advisory commission puts out an opinion that tribal governments are not governments for purposes of contributing funds to candidates or political parties. They're tribal governments for purposes of what they need to be as tribal governments, but for purposes of America's elections, they are not governments, they're persons. And that was in May of 2005. Now, there's not a single, your city government, my county, your state, there's no government in the United States that can cut a check to a candidate or a political party. But tribal governments do it in big numbers to both political parties because of that little advisory opinion that became law of the land. The next thing that happened was the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, where, by golly, they're going to rein in all this big spending in elections. And they did this. And so McCain and Feingold put this reform, campaign finance reform. I made three separate trips to D.C. on my own dime, begging both of those senators to please include two words, Indian tribes, because if the terms are not expressly in print in a statute, they're exempt. So McCain-Feingold went through without those two words, and McCain later said, oh, it was an unintentional inadvertent consequence. From 2000 until 2002, now these tribes are all moneyed up big time with gaming, and mind you, the gaming money is pretty much free. They are federally subsidized for housing, education, health, law enforcement, tribal courts. All their basics are federally subsidized by you and me, so the gaming profits are pretty much free money. And they're used to buy what I call the four L's. That gaming money buys land, it buys litigators, legal counsel, it buys lobbyists, and it buys legislators at every level of government. That's what the casino gaming money is primarily used for. So between 2000 and 2010, when the Supreme Court overturned McCain-Feingold and opened up the funding for other organizations and entities, I certainly didn't approve of the Citizens United ruling that just bloated too much money into elections, but I was relieved that the Indian gaming dollars were not the only big money in town for 10 years. And during that 10-year period, the halls of Congress were just packed with lobbyists. Governor's offices, state legislators, every local level, tribal governments were literally purchasing our elected officials. And this is a population that's about 4% of our country. But there's only about 1% that's actually enrolled in a tribal government. So this is huge political influence on the system. And that set the stage for even more perks and more things coming online up to this year of 2016.
And the other thing I learned from you yesterday was that a lot of the residents on the reservations, I don't know if it's all reservations or just, I mean, I'm not sure the numbers. I know you are. But a lot of those people are not tribal members.
Yes. And that's the funny part, because the folks that live in
pretty common,
the urban area.
Uh-huh.
Pardon?
Yeah, I guess that's pretty common.
It's absolutely common, because they were opened up. They were opened up to everybody, And the other thing that your average listener, and certainly the people in D.C., are oblivious to all this, these Indian reservations do not set in a vacuum. Every single Indian reservation is co-located within a state, within counties, within towns. And so there's dual jurisdictions and dual conflicts over jurisdictions. And almost every reservation except two that I'm aware of are predominantly non-Indian. Where I lived in Hobart is 80% non-Indian or more.
How can they? How can that be? Explain that a little bit. What do you mean, non-Indian?
Well, hold on. We're having a train wreck here. Better take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Because we have like a lot of questions. We don't want to take a break. We don't have time for breaks.
Okay.
We're going to do it anyway, though. Bob said we have to. Bob's mean. We'll be back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. Oh, she's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. B
village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line. You can find me in my...
Now you swear, kicking Vegas, that you're not a gambling man. Then you'll find your back in Vegas with a handle in your hand.
little gambling song there for us. Bob's going to leave no stone unturned today. So let's see, for people who kind of coming in late and might get distracted by the news break coming up here, we are speaking with Elaine Willman, the author of Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. And dismantling, explain the title, Elaine. And then we'll go back to the story after the break.
You know, my editors picked that title because I couldn't figure out. The book is about a road trip. Some of your listeners may remember the old Thelma and Louise movie about these two wacky broads that took a road trip. And the book is about myself and a videographer traveling from Washington State to New York across 17 Indian reservations. We held the camera up and interviewed. We just wanted to listen, and we listened to tribal members, to teachers, bankers, sheriffs, farmers, ranchers, folks that live on these reservations. And it was a life-changing trip for me because what we were hearing across the country was really alarming. And I'd promised every single one of them that we would get their stories told, but we couldn't fit it all into a little documentary. So I transcribed 130 hours of film, and nobody even asked me to change their names. And that's the book, Going to Pieces. It's that trip, and you sort of hear these interesting personal experiences while learning about Indian policy. So dismantling there is, and it's on steroids right now in 2016, there is this dramatic effort to expand tribalism as an authority that replaces state authority and replaces the governing jurisdiction of counties and towns and removes the state protections of the citizens that live on the reservation. As I said, most folks that live on reservations are non-Indians. They're citizens of their state. But the feds are helping these tribal governments now. They're extending their own federal authority out to tribes to govern non-members. That's never been allowed. It's certainly not in their own tribal constitutions, which limit them to their property and their people. But they're rolling out tribalism to supplant state authority in a very big way. And it's a collusion of several of the agencies coming out of the Secretary of Interior's office, the BLM, the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's quite a collusion that is using tribal governments and Indian reservations as launch pads to dismantle the state protections for property owners and citizens. And there's now directly attacking and capturing state waters, state energy, and going after the crop production, the feds are. That's where this is.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten into the crop production part. There's a lot more to this. We could do a week of radio. So we have another hour with Elaine here, and I hope you'll stick with us. Ton of information on the website and how you can get this information and do your own research. WeThePeopleRadio.us.